Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Poet Radio, August 2025. My name is Chris Funkhauser. Tonight on the program, my guest is Stephen Cope. Stephen is a professor at Hobart and William Smith College. We know each other from our years together in Santa Cruz, where he grew up. What we're doing this evening is, as listeners of the program will know, we had a tribute to Cole Heinowitz 2 months ago after her tragic passing. And Stephen had the experience of being Cole's partner the last part of her life. And I had the idea to have him come on the air and do his tribute as a special offering to the listeners who knew Cole, loved Cole. He agreed to do it. He wanted to do it. And basically, I think the structure of the show tonight will be Stephen reading some of his poems and some of Cole's poems. And, you know, there may be times when we break into conversation. But Stephen, thank you so much for coming down and recording here today. We're recording in the Q25 studio here in Tivoli. Ladies and gents, my dear friend Stephen Cope.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again. Whether this is a tribute or a testament or a dirge or simply an act of mourning, I don't know. It may be all or it may be something completely different, but I do want to read some of the poems that Cole was working on. He was working on a manuscript and had typed a number of poems out that she left with me, and also had written a number of pieces and worked on a number of pieces in some of my notebooks next to my poems also. And I think I'll start with the poems that are in the notebook. There's actually a number of versions of them. Some are typed out, but versions might be precisely the point. These were poems that about 30 years ago now, Meow Press published a little chapbook of mine called Version Vertige that I almost immediately was uninterested in. But Cole had gotten hold of a copy of that and recently had read it with musical accompaniment and recorded that after a couple of practice sessions. And the entire book, which was very moving for me, even though I had more or less disowned the poem as, I don't know, some sort of late juvenilia. But she was into it. And in fact, we ended up talking about it quite a bit. And she talked me into liking it again. Cole was very good at that, I believe. She explained to me what was going on in the poem that I either wasn't aware of or had forgotten was going on in the poem, relating it to the heart physiologically and symbolically, figuratively and physiologically, I guess I would say. The conceit was that it was several versions of a single poem, thus Version Vertige. So the collection was called Version Vertige, but it was versions. They weren't necessarily separate poems, nor were they simply a single serial poem. The way they worked was by essentially sequencing, by means really of the ear more than anything else, different snippets of text. Found text, I guess one could say, although a lot of it was found in my own notebooks, lines that I liked but that were not in a poem or were in a bad poem that I didn't like. So I liked the line but not the context. And then other bits of text that came from books or other writers that had stuck with me or that were unavoidable or that I had to deal with in some way. And just text that was in the environment. She began working on poems that were based on the same sort of procedure, strategy, method. I don't think it's any one of those things technically, but that were born out of a similar practice, I suppose. And What I'm going to do is, because she wrote some of these in a notebook right next to some of my poems, and then convinced me to start writing a new set of these poems called Edition Vertige, which many of which I've written since she has left. So I'm going to go back and forth between the two, because they seem to work well in conversation with each other or as a kind of mashup. And I don't know what the title is. Her titles are, one is titled Fermat Bay. Fermat Bay is another title. And Compressed, it seems to be another title, possibly, although that could just be a description of what that draft is doing. Anyway, I'm going to read this for a while. So, Edition Vertige, or Fermat Bay, or Fermat Bay. I'll dedicate mine to Mat Vey as well, because we love Mat Vey. The devil bites dirty, but the world does dirtier than worse. When emptied out of sorrow, skin for skin and all, show your face. It's natural to grow choicelessly, even away is a place. Extra cash will come from sons. It's a miracle. The nation keeps falling down helplessly. We don't need pictures for proof of this any longer or any more worry after one more holiday. The flaming soil there, where there used to be a blossom for a second in the snow. But then I can't do much today to save you. Just shower. Fermat Bay, Fermat Bay to you, you're the one sort with every blood in this half vessel ruptured, talking forgotten business. I tell myself and I tell himself I would be azure, hand on heart, hogtied in a parking lot, a family handed back to me. Shaky bridge, falling tower, strange the isolated man is desire, and I beat her, they said, to nothing. People change in two, but the many that we are is to laugh instead of be split open, give birth to clarity, the sense of an own after the pardon in my touch, so you begin. Strange that the dimming rooms are invisible. All these books we have across an arm from you stagger through, but that's prior to arrangement. The pages are dirty. That's the point. The light in a house doesn't mean, therefore, you can call it a lighthouse. You can call it anything you'd like or not. Like, I mean, who needs, after all, a stage? Stacked as such, a panoply of compounds, especially near the orange wine, where they can appear in casual, nearly or totally a building, I was thinking. The street, yet there are no lights out on it now. The hour is happy. You are so happy that even on the back of my tongue, still flat, I can feel you sucking on me barely like a finger or a nerve. A bee may be capable of taking this out from what there is of me in it to a separate beginning. Even we are speaking in a manner of a fact we've included, that memory now appears to be mine entirely, but that is not a generation. I will be a color and I will climb in your mouth, hot stuff. We'll find the line from the nipple clear as more potatoes. Balm stool, the half fatherland. Come here steadily in the great gagging of the night and the vocabularies of the foist, unattended morphine depots. It's not over our nation, which is infanticide. The frozen air should not lead our lives kneeling at the imaginary telephone. White noise, the girl's name is men. This is not the river, but a long shadow I will save in jars by pulling out my ribcage. Talking, angry at the clay as they fill, the rough will change blindly as walls, untuned to death, and then sleep. The earth speaks, and like a large dock, family's salamander, I would. There is no one here but us, talked, carrying objects like pollinate a pink daffodil chickens quite sufficient. A bearded screen or a soft, absolutely what they say, in kind and half mad you reign, androgynous so are not helping. They will exist. I have the soundtrack. Coldest hours, I am good, running through your head. Fill me up. Shaky bridge. Is it the same world? I like falling tower. Strange, I am bad. Find me. The devil bites dirty, but the world does it dirtier than worse. When emptied out of sorrow, as filthy as you are, you bury me. Beloved, you plant me in your soil, though neither you nor I were ever boy or girl enough to say, do you really want to hurt me and mean it? Every time I see you fall, I get down on my knees and taste the bitter, salty viscousness and tears upon your tongue again, just so somebody else can last. As if that were enough, we are actually the same as the medicine. The devil bites dirty, though. The world is wax and worse. It's impersonal, a moon and that which was not, a moon with which we had not a single thing to do. That strain itself makes of infinity a term to cast aspersion so widely, but why when everyone explodes insofar as they are national or not, just skin for skin, not at all in the sense of being paid to be finally free of all this liberty. It's cold outside. You really got to protect yourself. Because your boyfriend, the first to respond to the word never, that isolated man may honorably keep his disagreement well dead on another girl, distance if he can, bleaches nothing but the many that appeared and I beat her and greens. Corporations we are, as to laugh instead of be split open, shall give, they said, 2 years strange for the youngest birth to his own father. Arson people change, and two people I know sooner or later live in the purple dozen rooms, return a hero, buildings with the oldest fog, lines in my touch, over and over great world that is mad, things have happened. I, city of the corporations, so hot peace, have so far to go, think everyone is rescued, or so you have chosen. So that the juice may fill them in, listen to the last thing you would stop, back, hate. No one can say why or see witnesses out in the city. Crime late enough, you're through water in a public that you're still thinking. Lumpy purple womb, stained brute of speech. They make about honey with rabbit, and indeed they wore loose, one must. Honor cannot bear it. The juices were, I suppose, I. Where have you been? How would you like a drink? To ask, shall we know a new rabbit? Emptied out of sorrow, a psalm is such patiently between the earth and the earth. Bound and bound, shared should ingratiate the peasantry. So when compelled with caution, years make history a worthwhile cause to a gardener. You can dance, but do you really want to hurt me, honey? The bees have nearly fled the landscape and pigmentations. Nightly we feed upon the men under the window air, near the sounds growing dim in the sands as they pass near a vehicle. The thorns fading into grim absolution. The balcony is tired. It will not hold summers together. The nation is peculiar and redundant. Fermat Bay, to you, you're the one But the many that we are is to laugh instead of be split open, give birth sooner or later. The purple when I speak, I don't speak, which is in some sense our home, ergonomic artery. The city is insane, the insane fly, we want to say. Trusting, they feel themselves at the end of a chain, so we know that lives are single vexed blade. And the guilt of Christmas, kneeling at midnight, investing, jostling, figuring, quivering, the query, I suppose, and we try to imagine that we belong to those patterns. The earth speaks, the spring comes, fragments. Again, I love the word touches, ennobling, if one thinks so, fellows. They said the word is the obvious, the seen, the unforeseeable. They are gaslighters. Hogtied in the parking lot and mess tents, in hospitals and sheds in a ruined country, like a large deck, families talked, carrying objects like a beaded scream or soft rain androgynous so that they will exist. I have the coldest hours. I am good. I am bad. Find me. You invent me. You invent my toes, invent my fingers, invent my chin, invent my lips, invent my tongue, beloved. Invent my armpits and nipples, every hair between my legs. Please invent me again so that I may exist. The archive's a uterus, so unlike that one which you placed more sensibly inside my feelings, where you do not begin for me. I do not, hands on knees, kneeling face to face as a vase is in black and white, you bury me. No, oh Habibi, there is dust. Even the motes are weeping, illumined by the shared light, staining through a glass tableau. Though, if we'd given birth to tulips, they would have your eyes. Woe. We are not coeval. There is no one here but us chickens.
All right.
Well, we'll stop with that. That's about 4% of it, but it does go on.
If you're tuning in a little bit on the late side right now, this is Poet Radio, and just been listening to Stephen Cope reading works by Cole Heinowitz. I noticed, Stephen, that there's mainly we're looking at pages of notebooks, and then there was a one page that had been fully typed out, and then the whole of all those words, only a few of them emerge as the poem. Do you know what's up with that?
I don't. So there's one typescript of about 7 pages, but it's typed in single space in 2 columns,
yes.
Left-hand column, right-hand column, and there's large sections of it are crossed out.
Right.
And so I don't know if this is again, it's a version, so I don't know if it's a draft or if it is, it's a typescript of a recording of her speaking. I mean, one of the things you may, for those who know Oppen, you'll certainly recognize that almost half of them, perhaps, are coming from Oppen's poetry and coming from the day books, Oppen's day books and papers.
Some of the City of Corporations, is that from Oppen?
That's from Oppen.
Yeah,
a lot of it is Oppen. We Are Coeval from Oppen. There's No One Here But Us Chickens is from Oppen. So
it's such an amazingly... Even if it is some sort of mashup, it's the whole thing is so fluid.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's very much about rhythm, I think. I don't know. Cole was the only person who seemed to really get... I mean, there was 2 or 3 people maybe who sort of got, when I first published that book, that it was... I had thought it was a poem of really grief and trauma, but when I read it out loud, people tended to laugh a lot.
You're talking about Virgin Vertige?
Virgin Vertige, right. Which is what these are sort of coming out of. So what I just read was about half Cole's and half mine, going back and forth between them. So they're in because they're just, that's the way they appear in the notebook, sort of in conversation with one another. It's very much about rhythm, and there is something about it to me that speaks to grief and trauma, or speaks from that, really. Certainly nostalgia and loss. But I think maybe it was just the period of time. Everyone sort of assumed everything was, you know, ironic and playful if it was working in any sort of disjunctive way like that. So I don't know. And there were perhaps some phrases that could be quite funny, like "No one here but us chickens." So again, these were poems that she left with me. So I don't, you know, some of them certainly appear to be complete as they are. Some have notes.
It's
some
almost
are poems
like
that have been published elsewhere before. Most of them are for someone.
But this is also like kind of cut up, right? Because she's going across the two columns,
yes,
reading the last part of one line and then jumping across.
Yes.
And
it's all cut up. Yeah, I mean, from the beginning, it's cut ups. It's, you know, phrases that stick with one, wherever they are from, and then lines from one's own writing, notebooks or poems or whatever, sort of put together. She sort of assembled, you know, we assembled them according to different rhythms. I mean, our own rhythms at different times, I suppose. But there were a lot of points of convergence, or certainly resonance between the two.
Can't wait to hear some more, Stephen.
But yeah, I'll read a few here that I didn't read the other night. Inspired speech. The poems are mostly for people. They're written for people. So this is for Carla Harriman, with whom Cole was close, going way back, 30 years at least, as long as we have known her, perhaps. Want to try to help me put this in? The cordon flowed loose in my fingers, and the grackles on the lawn set forth toward the house. I know I can't simply sit down and confront the alternating current of domestic's aisle and forced intellection, but still the morning rises in appliqued languor, ready to be traded at the nearest toll, you know, flying about, yet holding the space to receive diligence of concentration. If I generally believed these birds would be still, I would have stopped waiting for the quiet years, though turning over the image of sitting at a desk now serves a certain adhesive function in the air around the sofa. What has been framed as a battering ram of creative pursuits, D2 messes, nibbling carrots, and waiting for the egg to boil, all that I know of inspired speech is simply this. I haven't read that one out loud before, so I'll read a couple of these. There's a few shorter ones. I'm not going to read the letter to Charles Olson. That's out there, but this one's for Eric Ullman. Sofia Kovaleskaya's necklace. We often forget we are never mind at play in evolved unspoken rights. Scarcely the whip stitch of a roadside cardigan fluttering between signposts that both affirm and deny the oncoming swerve. That is why twilight delights in tiny notations of faith, in notation or what it's like to open your mouth and try to speak inside a star. This is for Joe Elliott, poem as electric chair. It already sounds like a Depeche Mode 12-inch, how before we were masochists or converts, there were no accommodations, and the very idea of an institution playing God had just graphically committed suicide and genocide and won, leaving us orphans and widows working leather bars to get our PhDs in Norse sagas, as if missionaries untouched by time visiting Rexroth and Wieners in the Dust Bowl singing songs of order. I'm a punk who draws underwater where industrial stream loses all power to conduct. and my people transcribe the electromagnetic perturbations while our free organs improvise, as yours will continue doing after tonight, watching cephalopods dance in a Disney movie. But come, you've forgotten the last wish, part of the ritual where we sing in unison, the common links of human life. Cortisol, Control, Pasolini, Fassbinder, Luther, Brother Antonitis, Adelphi, the cops, chlordiazepoxide, the clan, boondocks, and towering far above them all, the never-ending tiers of Holy Mountain with its never-ending trail of pilgrims.
Yeah.
I mean,
wow.
Put the Brother Antoninus reference in there, bringing us back to the old days. Yeah,
exactly. We talked about him quite a bit. Paul and I, we like books.
Yeah.
The day before we went up to the river, we had gone to a bookstore in Santa Cruz. Incredible books of all sorts. And a lot of rare books, also a lot of sort of saddle staple pamphlets of various sorts and poetry and other things. And we ended up spending about 5 hours, huge boxes of books and pamphlets. I mean, among the things we found, I don't know if I told you this, we found a copy of a pamphlet on social credit that had the receipt $1 and then a receipt signed to Ezra Pound, the purchaser of the book. Who apparently sent a dollar for this, book on social credit, which, of course, is economic, proto-fascist economic thing. And this was just sort of a pamphlet sitting there that, in this box where pamphlets go to die, like a pamphlet graveyard in this bookstore. But, it was a really eclectic selection. I think that's one of the things Cole and I were first... talked about one of the first times. I think the first time we spoke. I remember we talked about Spicer and dictation, which of course is important to me now for various reasons. Somehow we ended up talking about the fact that we're both also interested in 13th century Andalusian philosophy, and we were both reading Maimonides, which seemed very strange and unusual for a couple of, she was 19, I was 23 or 24, but... Yeah, that seemed to be something that was constantly happening. We were stumbling upon these obscure things at the same time, independently. But so it was nice to do that together and stumble upon a bunch of weird things. But I haven't read through all the books yet. But well, let's see. I could read. These are longer poems. They're all very long. And I want to make sure I do the one that's the demon acorn, but...
We have time, Stephen, and reminding listeners that we're listening to... At the moment, we're listening to Stephen Cope reading the poetry of Cole Heinowitz. And I guess in the beginning of the program, poems that were combining his words and her words.
Yeah. Or our words, perhaps.
Yeah.
I think there are so many words of others in there that it's... begins to seem authorless at some point.
Yeah, but that's all right.
The collective, yeah. I do have I've been writing a lot to Cole. We've been corresponding quite a bit in the last few months. She remained quiet for a bit, but has been a little more talkative lately, I suppose. And this is about the seventh section from this poem that just ends up in sections as they come and has been going on for a few months now without any editing by me or anything like that. But any poem ever composed by those or that other than the poet who will still get credit is, whatever else it is, merely an attempt to make laminar the surface of a turbulent river in hell. And even if you can build a boat out of all the broken furniture in the world, if you ever want to see your beloved again, you're gonna have to get wet. and you're going to have to stay hard, and you're going to have to go deep. Deeper than any merely gendered body could ever permit. In order to give birth to a tulip that would have both of our eyes. That's one section. I think she was trying to tell me something, but I'm going to read this poem, "The Invocation of My Demon Acorn." This poem is very much written as an address to different people. I know a lot of it's addressed to me. It's addressed to others too, and speaks of me in the third person. It also speaks of a number of other people in the third person. So it's a poem that's very much about friendship, groups, others, finding oneself in a group of lovers, those one loves. Christopher's in the poem amongst many other people. And there are a number of lines in the poem that come directly out of conversations that Cole and I had over the last, going back 16, 17 years. And I imagine there are those in the address to others that I wouldn't necessarily recognize, but I'm going to read it. "Invocation of My Demon Acorn." Erase the lines of the night couch pendulum as protection for the cat when sadistic thoughts curve through your mind. That's what Will said, but I like practicing faith before the open face of day. Mom's schooling me to put on my big girl pants for the divorce hearing while dressing her dying husband's separating wound, and I dart her a glance that asks if she's got hers on now, and she winks and whispers, "Sweetheart, I never wear those." "Leave the poor cat alone," we laugh at the man pretending to be a lion in the zoo on the wrong side of the bars, just a banged-up parcel of strivings, hanging by an arbitrary protein bond, like submarines formed when superior loop enforcements cry from the depths, making silver pools of oil in the ocean of faith. You see, you can already hear it in my voice, how after 50 years on this suffering planet, I worship every inch of clean growth in electromagnetic pulses the lion man couldn't have imagined in his wildest nightmares. Even if I could just tell you all the things I talked about with Stephen. Anagogy, midrash, the vocables of fairy queens, each one a precise point on the meridian of sexual joy. Or how Judy held me like a baby when my limbs were ripped apart by the angry God inside. Or when Chris delivered Amy's houseplant to my door, wearing a giant grin and white jeans with sunflowers, and oh God, wait till I get to the stones and raw milk John gave me. You'll walk out still trying to cover your heart on, and we never even kissed. Are you beginning to catch my drift? How much bigger the mountain looks from upstairs where a million stars grow, morbidly aroused by the 50-foot flames and battery acid smoke billowing from the gash in my heart, swirling in the Santa Ana winds. You were right on the money there, Jack. Nothing can match the stars' unrelenting drive to express their desire in the eternity of blackness. George, apparently there's something funny in your interview with Ted, and I don't need a microfiche reader to find out what anymore. I could even print and distribute all 18 pages as love gifts just because I hear music in my head and want my lovers to hear it too. My first time in the Arcane Lavender Archive, Linda made me catalog the papers of a Swedish plasma physicist and electrical engineer, but on breaks, I'd sneak over to where Will was ripping entrails out of his cat and burying his face in their heat. Had he only let us out of Egypt, it would have been enough. Must he also slay their firstborn? Give us all their money, part the sea for us, then drown them in it. No one in this country likes an anti-Zionist Jew. It's considered a patriotic duty for Holocaust survivors and their offspring to stand as alibi for another holiday in someone else's misery. There's a name for that, you know, but even Germans are only allowed to scream it underwater or at the opera, and no, the first word ain't justice. It's Schadenfreude. Miss Jackson, if you're nasty. You see, I am not interested in casual anything, and only now remember that I never have been. Sheba has kept reminding me in her badass way for 30 years, and I still forgot until last week. Genuine heartbreak, the kind only a parent can inflict, brings out my self-destructive tendencies and has done so all this time, causing me to forget things anyone who talks to me for 5 minutes invariably knows. Do I sound like I'm drunk? I promise you the rest of the Sabbath in the anagogical sense signifies the repose of everlasting blessedness, and I haven't had a drop to drink, though I also admittedly haven't eaten. So Ted, make me laugh. Let's see how many times you can shift questions about the relationship between conjugal and communal eros to glassware at the place Mary and George were staying. Stephen was right. It's all about drinking. Plus, this American novelist just happens to drop by and has a truly asinine concern with dying by absorption in a group. I'm not telling you these things to produce a calculated effect, to convey a set of opinions, or to impart knowledge of any sort. I am telling them to you because these days, more than ever, it is incumbent on us to report to each other from each of our individual fronts, which is what I told Bill. Of course, the principle of divide and rule is at work behind the very concept of identity, and there ultimately is no one that will look out for you. As Erica's mom, taking the wide view of history, wisely informed her kids, man, Erica, that was a true gift. Because a kid who grows up pathologized like me is set up to expect some magic man will just round the corner and suddenly their pain will disappear. Also, to be fair, it's actually the American novelist who just dropped in, not Ted, who's putting Mary to work with such apparent geniality about the drinks. For his part, Ted is making fun of this guy I now imagine as a kid saying, well, I'm a tough morsel to swallow, I'll tell you. But then really trying to help him out by explaining how it works, meaning you hope someone younger comes along and becomes the hot new center of the group. That's what makes it a group, really. His patience and compassion are extraordinary. He doesn't scruple to answer questions like, who is famous in that group? Because the bottom line is, you make friends with people you share interests and admirations with, then you make stuff together, and things like friendship and love grow from making things together. But then, finally, praise God says, listen, kid, this isn't what we came to talk about. I never considered whether or not the objectivists had some kind of group cohesion. There was just that one issue of, Oppen says, yeah. And later it was really sort of a collective, a way to get printed at a time when I think that none of us could, except maybe Williams, who was unsatisfactorily printed anyway. So it was that, but it was that among people who like each other's work, or liked it more or less, Berrigan says, same with us exactly. More blockhead novelist Cohen than. Ha, good one. George says Reznikov not only hadn't, but never intended to read any of the others. And of course, Williams wouldn't like Zukovsky. And of course, it's maybe surprising to Ted in 73 that Rex Roth was in that one issue of Poetry too, but he's got sense enough to know sometimes today's surprise imagines yesterday was planned ahead by sociologists. But man, it turns out George has been fielding this group fetish thing all week from young poets. And then, as now, they call that a conference on contemporary poetry. As in, why continue corresponding with people who don't get you? So yeah, a group is more or less personal friends, and the basis of the friendship is essentially the work you're called to in company. Mary clarifies, George was the baby because Lewis was 6 years older, and Ted says by the 70s that six had grown to a dozen. The interloping novelist is named Tom. For all Ted and George's grace and generosity, fielding questions like, who are the famous people from your group, Mary's the only one to address the moron by name. Remember how Haitians trying to escape the genocide across the border to the Dominican Republic were gagged to death with handfuls of parsley when asked to say the word perigil, their gil, instead of heal, a dead giveaway. I learned about passwords where the U.S. side of the southern border is policed entirely by Chicanos and Chicanas who'd have to detain their own mothers. But nothing like what the Arab-Israeli guards at a West Bank checkpoint taught me about shibboleths. It's not some secret abracadabra, it's just shalom. I'm saying the parents of nearly every border guard would have been detained or worse, which is why they developed a joke password that worked much better for everyone. Shalosh, the number 3 in Hebrew. I don't know if I'm explaining myself. Imagine a cop pulls you over for speeding on a Saturday night, makes you walk a straight line, and you execute perfect cartwheels into a ditch. My mother-in-law at the time would have been detained, so there was an inside joke. One June 16th at the courthouse at 100 Center Street, sometime in the early 19th century, Lenny Bruce went on trial for obscenity. Testifying for the defense were drama critic Richard Gilman, columnist Dorothy Killigan, and Nat Hentoff from The Village Voice, the editor of Ebony, a Columbia professor of comparative literature, cartoonist Jules Pfeiffer, sociologist Herbert Gans, a Presbyterian minister named Forrest Johnson, and Jason Epstein, vice president of Random House. Also, Ginsburg put together a petition of big intellectuals to save him, and hundreds of demonstrators turned out before the trial, and Lenny got 4 months in the workhouse, which proved to be excellent fodder. Why does this freedom-squelching anecdote from a vaguely familiar history matter now? If you promise to really listen to me, to listen with your heart instead of that AI who insists it's been running the show from upstairs since Newton established the laws of motion, Descartes the principle of mind-body dualism, and Watt's steam pump became the reigning metaphor for the body's most powerful source of perception, I'll tell you. It matters because there's another mode of knowing our species has practiced for most of its time on the planet, but has forgotten how to access and been taught to degrade as blood sacrifice to receiving the boons of literacy and culture, as rough a trade as genital mutilation, if the goal is to feel at home in the world and keep faith freely without coercion or threats about the afterlife. All who have carried the first people's knowledge report the same identical thing. They learned the use of plants as medicine from the plants who told them directly. And the anthropologist's suggestion that more likely it was trial and error just makes them laugh. But now, right here where we gather in hospitals, courtrooms, morgues, and all the places where we worship at the feet of the false god data, things are suddenly strange again. Because we know the bias and exclusion he must perforce enact to keep his status as guarantor of the real, while we're fumbling about in the mists of phenomena, projecting ourselves on our fellow blank screens. If this isn't a poem, I won't cut out my tongue. I have too much reverence for the demon who designed the pattern I am bound to manifest, but how to react No quantity or quality of craft can silence this question when you live in language. You can never precisely pinpoint the border between speech and music. Zhukovsky drew the line with an intentionally heavy hand, I think, because I can see the circumstances in old photos and can tell when he's secretly joking by speaking English with the rhythm and inflection of a Yiddish insult. I'm not even mad at my friends who spent the last 30 years being clever and smug, singing the songs of Orpheus while calculating probability like card sharps, because suddenly nobody was telling the truth in public and we felt the new silence in our protoplasm. I'm not joking or bending English to a meter you don't know. Epigeneticists can trace the passage of such trauma to the exact time and place of insemination. When egg and sperm change behavior under duress, as all organisms do, just think of a clown riding a unicycle. There is no stasis, no matter how many words a picture's worth. Equilibrium, yes, but dynamic, like that iambic pentameter that just now came out of nowhere. Scan Coolidge's prose and you'll see it, plain as day. Pepper and salt, the death young men dream of. Because as any chemist will avow, no stable boundary divides life from non-life. And as any poet or musician can attest, dead men do tell tales unceasingly, though still taught to us in books. The law of the excluded middle has never been proven. Or consider the pharmacopoeia in which D-chlorocysteine, synthesized a century ago to treat TB, augments neuroplasticity almost as much as the anesthetic ketamine, compounded to euthanize horses, and therefore an ample supply for field surgeons during the Great War, where every soldier who survived came to with accounts of seeing God, and decades later the anti-epileptic lamotrigine supplanted lithium as first-line treatment for bipolar disorder, meaning it met the scientific method's repeatability requirement. And if you've ever seen an ancient Chinese map of the meridians, you'll instantly grasp why pre-diabetic opera singers with stage fright no longer need beta blockers once their daughter prescribes Ozempic. Yeah, science is grand if you've got the patience of a saint and can accept error after error after error as the vehicle for progress because your medical textbooks were already 90% wrong by the time they were published. But I remember a time when the symptoms that now legally authenticate my disabilities were what's called having a personality. It wasn't so long ago that walking everywhere with headphones on didn't signify the dissolution of the social contract by mass pathology, just that it's lovely to hear music while in motion, peripatetic, coincident with. So I'm hopeful, even though it took Steve Jobs and a pandemic to bring back the Walkman and withhold judgment as to whether the cigarettes prescribed as bronchodilators for my grandma's asthma before the advent of penicillin really caused her death by cancer. From what little we know about our ancestors and my own experience with hunger, I'm even confident that scarcity is more than a convenient rationale for capitalism or social Darwinism. It's how all self-organized systems execute a hard reset. It's really not as hard as I would have expected after 5 decades of inculcation as the kind of physiological and psychiatric anomaly that makes research scientists wet or hard or both. With visions of major publication and seismic paradigm shifts. I'm ashamed to admit it, but I even became a little proud on that account, knowing my doctors had skin in the game and good reason to actually care about me. But the downside of all this will be clear to everyone now living in the Western world. Foucault called it care of the self. I call it symptom hypervigilance. That is, if you've accustomed yourself to functioning with an incurable illness, you hone a special type of attention to ordinary things like ingestion, excretion, rate of motion, range of motion, etc. You notice aberrations in whatever current norm prevails, and you learn to flag and heed those aberrations as onset warnings. But here's how easy it can be to rescue personality from diagnosis. Marianne invited me to go to dinner, and I said yes, and it would be a real mitzvah on your part because I can't eat. So as not to cause undue alarm, I added that it's not a body image thing or anything like that. It's more like Kafka's hunger artist, who, after achieving wide acclaim in a zoological freak show, simply explains there just wasn't anything he wanted to eat. But then I recalled my automatic relish eating breakfast at the mission with Stephen and then dinner with my brother and niece. So it's really that eating in the absence of a loved one is unappealing. And Marianne says, I'm sorry for your difficulty, sweetie, but that's the loveliest reason I've ever heard for not eating. How kind she is, not placating, but an earnest saying, you're not sick, Cole, just anachronistically healthy. Hey, Lisa. Hey, Douglas. I'm so glad you could come. I've brought you avocados from my home tree, along with a correction that will bring you peace regarding refried beans. It's not that you have to fry them twice. They just taste better that way. I remembered this revisiting the Shea Cafe, where I cooked for 4 years. You'll also be happy to learn that the lease was renewed without anyone having to sue the Board of Regents. They even restored the murals of Angela Davis and Subcomandante Marcos, but since it's no longer a functioning restaurant, the painters didn't cop to the fact that Ya Pasta was an intentional malapropism. So now it reads as the original battle cry again, Ya Basta. Enough already. Instead of the slogan we invented for food not bombs riding the Jacobin Trail of gluten-free gluten from cake to free spaghetti. Sorry it's not a Padres jersey or a garishly colored Virgen de Guadalupe, but you've got enough of those. So assuming this isn't a poem and therefore it can't be an elegy, I'll continue addressing anecdotes to a flesh and blood beloved I can reach out and touch. Stephen and I gave up on trying to find the literature building and got lost trying to find the archive and couldn't agree on which floor of the library was the one they had to fill with concrete. But that gave us time to swap stories about old William Arctander. I hadn't known you were so close. And Stephen didn't know about the Tao Te Ching translation or how he made us read Philosophie dans le Boudoir, Juliette and Justine in 2 weeks, or the perennial line of red-hot gum-chewing blondes in miniskirts outside his office when I came to consult him on how to explain that Derrida is a Kantian, and the last chick in line invariably looks me up and down with palpable distaste and asks, are you waiting for Billy? Were your ears burning just past Eastern Standard Time, just past dusk Eastern Standard Time on January 15th? It's not like an avocado, so I don't know how such gifts travel, but if you suddenly felt flush that night, now you know it wasn't just the blinding bright light of shipwreck, humiliating in its disguises. And for those of you who never lived in California, please register my inflection when I say, are you waiting for Billy? You'll hear it again behind my putative meaning like a hidden Yiddish insult when this intimate tete-a-tete turns back into song. Anton, will you stand in a sec? I've barely had time to write this much out, and still, I have no idea about the death young men dream of. Yeah, you will? Yeah, sure, what I remember. I think it goes, I thought I could touch the stars. I lie awake at night. I don't know where you are. My face explodes, teardrops into tears, and every second I'm not with you. Well, it seems like years. I warned I'd kill you. I love you. Yeah, yeah, I won't die, but I don't feel the same. I spend all of my time hoping to see you again. Poets have a lot to learn from songwriters, who, by the way, also suffer more acutely from the collective disability that defines all living beings. Our failure to eliminate the furniture in the room and grasp that infinitely small and infinitely perfect vocabulary, silence. Maybe Jack set the bar just a tad too high, the same way Lewis did. To state an existential truth without hubris or pretension by openly failing in the very act of saying it. Given the predicament, there's no point remaining shy about asking you to hold me like a baby when the terror comes and to remind me that food is good. I'm 15 again, and also 5, and all that rage about having to be born again melts to nothingness, since for those born old, there's a mystic thread in the shattered pinata after the guests have all left their lean trail. You get to age backward, to do it over, to hold yourself or guide yourself the way it should have been done before, and lover, you realize that Sinead hit the nail on the head, and it isn't hyperbole. It's just like you said it would be.
Steve, I have to thank you profusely for taking time and going through the partly seemingly joyful and partly treacherous experience of sharing.
Well, it's, you know, it's beautiful work. So
I think it's important to get the work out there. Absolutely. And I didn't.
It's an amazing poem to read, but I'm so happy to be able to share this work or what I can of it, and to do whatever justice I can do to it, if any. It's not Cole's voice. My voice isn't, but, I think certainly that last poem anyway is so much her that it's impossible not to hear her in it.
Yes.
I feel it, obviously so.